It's like you're at a bar people have been making fun of you for a long time. This is America. And all of a sudden you just turn around and punch somebody in the face. Just randomly, doesn't matter who it is, whatever. And then everybody in the bar is like, oh, maybe we shouldn't make fun of them so much. We know for sure if we do X that Y is going to happen. But if you don't know, then you're up for miscalculation. If you're up for miscalculation, again, that's how wars start. It's people making mistakes.
All right, it's my birthday. You guys ready? Okay, here we go. Hello, world. I mean, just let it out. We're recording.
Hello.
Live, so.
Hello, world. Welcome to the 12th episode of Ameripod. This is a special edition. We're recording it here in Evergreen and on film. Two cameras, actually. We tried to do a Facebook live stream, but, you know, technology.
Yeah.
We're millennials, but we're not that millennial, you know?
Wi-Fi wasn't fast enough.
Yeah, Wi-Fi.
I still remember when we got an answering machine. It was a big moment.
All right.
Yeah. Somebody still has my
answering machine.
It's voicemail on your phone, right?
They actually have machines.
Yeah.
All right.
With tapes.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
It was amazing.
Anyways, welcome to the 12th episode of Ameripod. Like I said, we are at the HQ up here in Evergreen, Colorado, and a
undisclosed location.
Yeah, I might not tell you where we are. We're gonna take off the geotag on there. Ooh, I hope I did. Anyways. Sipping on some Tecate Mexican beer.
Sponsorship available.
Oh, I forgot the coconuts. This episode is not sponsored by Soul South today. But anyways, introduction here. I'm Blake Mannion, so you can see my face to the name. To my left here, John Kelly.
Hi, everyone.
Tyler Davis Mayo.
Hello.
And John Anderson.
Hi, everybody.
So what are we talking about today, boys? Globalism versus nationalism, I guess, is where we left off last time.
Yeah. Do we want to jump right into that, or do we
want to... Well, that was kind of what we hinted at the last podcast. We don't need to start there.
No,
I think there's some other current events that...
They got to go to the end of the episode.
Hold on, what time is it?
Today is the 8th of April.
And Tyler's birthday, by the way.
Yep.
It's my birthday.
Happy birthday.
It's my birthday.
Yeah. Big 2 a.m.
Yeah, this is how I chose to spend it.
April 8th, 2017, and the time that we started this podcast.
About 2:28 a.m.
Approximately.
2:29 I got now.
2:28
is when we started.
Right roll.
Sure.
Right,
I don't know what the seconds are, but... Anyways, yeah, let's kick it off.
Syria? Yeah, we have to start with the current events.
Right, so...
That was Syria.
The most recent... thing that happened in the news today was, or not today, but this week, would have been the Trump administration launching 59 missiles at the Syrian airbase just outside of the Mediterranean, which there have been some interesting conspiracy theories about so far.
We don't have enough time to cover
it. and then, of course, the chemical weapon attack.
Yeah, which happened what, the day before
all evidence was suicide.
Yeah. Happened the day before.
And then it happened on Tuesday, and then the strike happens late Thursday.
Yeah.
So they launched. So this is, again, we see, like, this, you know what's really interesting? Did you guys see the ripoff photo that they had of, this isn't good for a podcast, sorry everybody. Mm-hmm. But there was they took the same photo that Obama did during the, Osama raid. You know what I'm talking about? The one with him being like, Hillary going like this and him looking concerned. Took the exact same photo from the exact same vantage point. A, all white dudes.
Right.
Which is great. But number two, something I thought that was really interesting in that was that Sean Spicer was there in the room. And I think what that indicates is the emphasis that this was not a military strike designed to bring a resolution to a conflict. It was a military strike designed as a media strategy. Mm-hmm. And so there's some strategy going on here, but it's not about like taking out Assad or, you know, instituting a end of the conflict or anything like that. It's about Trump looking tough.
Yeah.
And so I'm very concerned. I mean, this is not, if you're going to take, like, I'm not necessarily opposed to this military strike absent of like its context. Mm-hmm. If you're going to use chemical weapons, there should be punishment for that. But it has to be tied into an overall strategy, and that's why Obama didn't punish Assad with a strike, because his strategy was ultimately, his number one chief concern was keeping the United States out of it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why he didn't do it. I don't think Trump has any idea.
Obama had a better understanding of like the consequences of war.
He had a what's next in his mind. I have very little faith that Trump has a what happens after this. He wants to just do this and move on to tax cuts.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is going to probably pull us in further.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I think the other thing that really just has to be like emphasized is
there's
like
an action to every, or reaction to every action.
Yeah.
That's right.
No. So, like, I think just like one good context that shows the importance of the events of the past few days is that, I mean, this is a proxy war between Russia and the United States, ostensibly, because the Russians are backing Assad's regime, and then the United States is backing the rebels. So you're basically, you're fighting each other, but not directly, right? That is the definition of a proxy war. Mm-hmm. And I have to question, with the last few events, does Trump know what a proxy war is? Does he?
He also didn't know that reforming healthcare would be so complicated.
Yeah, so it's not out of the realm of possibility. But, I mean, he has a lot of advisors around him who obviously do. So then the question becomes, so this is the United States' first attack directly onto Assad, on the Assad regime, on, like, military targets. It's all been just, like, through the rebels, basically, at this point, and fighting ISIS, right? So the question is, what will the response be? But also, that's a closer step towards, like, attacking Russia, right, in the, like, kind of conceptual.
Well, and the significant, we saw that when we had a sort of truce, we had an understanding set up with Russia over our air actions, where we would say, okay, FYI, we're coming in with this amount of this, attack, this right. sortie, blah, blah, blah. Russia suspended that cooperation right. after mm-hmm. this attack.
Right.
And so we are seeing a severe downgrade in relations mm-hmm. with lots of guns. And that's the thing, that wars don't start because people want them to, it's because people make mistakes.
Right.
Because people miscalculate. And so when you have lots of fast flying planes with lots of ordnance around each other, sometimes somebody fucks up and then we end up in a war.
Have they do they have any casualties from this attack? Has anything come up?
I haven't seen any specific
casualties. So I saw something about this and I'm not like, I need to really check it.
Freestyle for a second.
But it was that, because that agreement that you mentioned was not suspended yet, the United States told Russia that we were doing the bombing, then Russia told Assad, and then he pulled his people out of it.
Interesting. It's interesting. This is such a symbolic action. We saw planes flying out of there hours afterwards. It didn't actually... It's made for cable news.
I mean, right?
It's policy made for cable news, not for actually like solving policy problems.
It doesn't sound like they were trying to target the aircraft, were they? Just like the chemical weapons that were stored in the buildings?
They targeted munitions, I'm assuming the runways, although they must have very good equipment for repair. They did their very best to avoid casualties, I think. So they probably were going after materials and not material.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what's shocking is just the speed at which the chemical attack happened. It became a media sensation in the United States on both sides, people condemning the attack, and then Trump's response.
Yeah.
48 hours.
Well,
it is a quick turnaround time to change a policy that's been in place for years.
That's the big thing. Let me see if I can find this real quick. There's tweets of Trump back to 2013 being like, stay out of Syria, Obama. Don't launch a missile attack. And if this is a thing that he was willing to like blanket the Twitter airwaves with in all caps, there's like very aggressive tweets on this. And then in 2 days, completely switch around.
Yeah.
That's really fucking scary, because you have the Chinese trying to like play off of us and say, okay, you know, if we know for sure if we do X, that Y is going to happen.
Yeah.
But if you don't know, then you're up for miscalculation. If you're up for miscalculation, again, that's how wars start.
Yeah.
It's people making mistakes.
And well, Trump admitted, I don't know when this conversation was, but he was like, I'm flexible. I changed my mind. I'm able to change my mind. Which is, and now I've changed my mind.
It can be good, but it can also be bad. And one of the biggest reasons...
Right, be flexible on, like, birth control or access to...
Yeah.
And in terms of foreign policy, it's really, really important that you're consistent. Like, okay, so Trump will say, it's stupid that we told him we're going into Mosul at, like, XYZ time. Sure, I can see how that doesn't make sense on, like, on its face in that very narrow context. But the reason you do that, A, you're protecting civilians. B, it's because you have to be extremely consistent for your allies to trust you. And the United States has to have allies to act optimized around the world. That optimizes our actions. And so... being really crazy, like if I'm Estonia right now, I'm trying to figure out how to make a deal with the Russians because I am freaking out that Trump is either gonna nuke our country when the Russians roll in or not do anything about it or somewhere in that spectrum because he is so unpredictable.
Well, and we have been slowly increasing our ground forces there.
Obama put some in before he left.
Sure, yeah. And I do believe that they're planning on putting 700 more in. At this point,
are they moving?
That's what Rachel had, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are. So we have like the Bannon wing of like craziness and like Leninites who just want to burn it all down.
The nationalism.
Yeah. And then you have people like Mattis and McMaster in there who are like understand these things. They like they are part of the what we call the Washington Consensus, which is the basically everybody agrees on foreign policy. And that has kept, I mean, like, there's a lot of criticisms about that, but it has, in ways, resulted in unprecedented amounts of peace.
Yeah.
The last 70 years have been unprecedented amounts of peace. So, yes, we have done lots of bad things, but we haven't, we didn't have a nuclear war with Russia.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's a win, in my mind.
Yeah. We've effectively stopped World War III from happening multiple times. We were close.
Over and over.
Yeah, we were close a few times.
Shit. Cuban missile crisis. Yeah.
I mean, those are the types of things where it was knocking right on our door.
Yep.
And we got lucky with our foreign policy.
Yes.
Even though it was split decisions by JFK, we got lucky.
I mean, we're kind of entering a new Cold War, potentially.
Yeah.
So did you hear part of Trump's new, this is a little, we're going to jump to the different part of the world, but part of Trump's plan for South Korea dealing with North Korea, or just dealing with North Korea in general, is putting nukes in South Korea.
Yeah. I don't know if it's nukes, but
he said, I'm pretty sure that's, yeah.
I know there's like missile bases there, definitely.
But well, we already put up a missile defense system.
Yeah, missile defense system.
Which I think is now set up and ready to go. But I'm pretty sure, you guys correct me if I'm wrong. I heard that.
I don't know, but I'm not necessarily. I don't necessarily disagree with that.
The
reason you do that is so that that is a move towards deterrence.
Sure,
it is
absolutely
to say,
it's like the next step.
Yeah,
towards deterrence.
Sometimes, okay, I really hate this phrase, but this is kind of applicable.
What if that gets sometimes, South Korea blown up?
Well, sometimes you have to escalate to de-escalate,
right?
Which is something that I really don't like, but it is true. Right. And so sometimes you have to call a bluff and you say, look. If you launch one missile, we're coming for you,
right.
And so make sure it's worth it.
Yeah.
And that deterrence has actually kept the world safe for 70 years.
I don't disagree.
However,
with that.
We're dealing with the Kim regime and who the fuck knows.
And we're dealing with the Trump administration.
It's also an escalation.
So
I can also see it as an escalation, though.
It is an escalation.
So that's what is North Korea. Who,
yeah, North Korea. At some point, you have to meet escalation.
Right.
With, like
two of the craziest leaders in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah, but these
along
are not
with
the,
like,
I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah,
the
Philippines.
Oh, this is definitely true, by the way.
What it,
everyone from
details?
Breitbart to the Hill to NBC News
details?
Says.
It's part of their. It's a part. It's like
it
was mentioned as part of their suggestions for that dealing with that military situation.
Yeah. It's a possibility.
Yeah,
that's
a possibility.
Table.
I just that. I mean, like, it's not if it was in our neck of the woods. It, you know, obviously everybody would be freaking out, like, Russia's planting missiles in Cuba. But,
right.
Like, I just, for me, it's like, is that fair for the South Koreans? I don't know.
I think the South Koreans probably want it to.
Yeah,
they want to
I wouldn't
so.
Be surprised
they want to do
they
everything
it.
In their power to stop the Kim.
Because that what that does is it shows it is a symbol of investment. Mm-hmm. It is saying we're willing to put enough like hardware in here that we're gonna protect you.
Yeah.
And so that is probably as much a move for like the Koreans and let's say the Japanese, the Indonesians, and the Vietnamese. I mean, everybody in East Asia, that is a way of coming in and saying, we're gonna be with you. I mean, this is a little off topic, but like one of the reasons why Vietnam happened was because we needed West Germany to have without a doubt faith that we would defend them if the Russians rolled in, because otherwise they were going to create nuclear weapons. So we were like, do not do that. We swear to God we'll be there with you. And proof is we're in Southeast Asia fighting a stupid war in the jungle for basically no reason.
Sure.
Other than your faith.
Sure.
And so these are moves that like we make all the time.
I'm just saying, could we station them in a better place? Something that's not quite as threatening to the South Koreans.
No, because the problem is that Seoul, which has like a million people or something, is within artillery range of the North Korean border. So right. Like, if anything happens,
they're basically living in a war zone.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think they view it, Blake, as like, this is an aggressive move by the United States.
That's or it makes them less safe.
They're welcoming. They're welcoming because they probably think that it makes them more safe in the long run than less safe.
I hope so.
Because like, think about it, I would assume that they're relatively low yield, and so those are probably designed to like take out the North Korean artillery on that side of the border or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe go after known North Korean nuclear sites.
Right.
Something
right.
like that. Right. So, but no, this is, it's a chess move.
Yeah.
Of deterrence.
It's like putting your queen right up in front.
Yeah, it's like bring it, bitch.
It's like, what do you want to put out? Because I'm going to snatch it.
Exactly. So, it's powerful.
Well, I hope so. I hope that they're viewing it as that, and it's not freaking out all the South Koreans.
I don't think it is. I think it's
hope we're not freaking you guys out.
but what it has done with the development of nuclear weapons in North Korea and their ability, seemingly now, to be able to shoot potential warheads even to the west coast of the United States.
Yeah.
It's moved the atomic clock closer to midnight than it's mm-hmm. ever been.
2.5 minutes, I think we're at.
Two and a half minutes, which is, it's terrifying. And when you have a guy like Kim in his regime in North Korea, and you have a question mark in Trump about how he's going to react to stuff, you know, in the past we've been lucky to have people that step back and try to view things in a more long-term viewpoint when it comes to using power and using nuclear weapons, and I'm not convinced that Trump's going to be that guy who will take his foot off of the gas.
I think what this recent events in Syria have shown us is that Trump responds to like terrible images of children on cable news suffocating because of sarin gas or whatever, and so if he sees Seoul go up in a nuclear cloud, I think he will react very forcefully, because if we've seen one thing, he has to maintain like his
tough guy facade.
So I think you're totally right. I think that if anything happens, he will respond in kind and with more, and that is not good, because then what do the Russians do? What do the Chinese do? And then like they retaliate, then we retaliate, and then all of a sudden nuclear winter.
Yeah.
So right. like yeah. this.
And let's not forget that there is precedent for this in history over and over.
Right.
And over again.
Yeah. Like, that's
World War One. I mean, they let it.
People. One of the things that drive me absolutely insane is when people are like, the United States and China aren't going to go to war. And you're like, why? And they're like, because. And you're like, that is what everybody has said in the history of humanity before a war.
Yeah.
Literally, go back to World War One. You know, Germany and Great Britain were each other's number one trading partners in 1913.
Wow.
We're like, it will happen. The only way it doesn't happen is if we're all so goddamn terrified of it happening that we keep it from happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what nuclear weapons are.
I wonder how the millennials in China feel about it.
Yeah,
write us. I know you guys are watching. Seriously, like, we definitely have viewers in China. So,
but I think this discussion about North Korea and my example with Vietnam and Germany is actually a good launching point for globalism versus nationalism, because as we've seen, like, every move on the board affects all the other moves on the board. And that's why nationalism is irrelevant.
Yeah,
or not irrelevant, it's quickly becoming irrelevant. It's just bad, it's just a it's not a good way to like view the world because it is not the reality that we see.
Yeah.
I wonder what Kim Jong-un and North Korea, what they are thinking right now after seeing Trump react so quickly and so aggressively on such short notice.
Some amount of caution, I would assume. I mean,
yeah.
This is not on its face a bad move.
Right.
The problem with it is devoid of strategy. It is just, it is a good, like, it's like you're at a bar and people have been making fun of you for a long time. This is America. And all of a sudden you just turn around and punch somebody in the face, just randomly, doesn't matter who it is, whatever. And then everybody in the bar is like, oh, maybe we shouldn't make fun of them so much. But, like, that
totally
doesn't mean, like, what's next. There's no connection to that point.
Right.
And so,
there's always that guy in the bar who wants to pick a fight with that guy.
Exactly. And that guy is Putin. And so, we're going to be, like, this on its face is not bad, but it is so devoid of. And we've seen. Okay, so here's a good example. You have to have your tactics.
I love how we just like compared America to the
some random
bar.
You have to have your tactics, your operations, and your strategy make sense with each other, or sometimes they can actually reinforce each other in negative ways. Good example of that is Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor was such an operational success that it pissed off America so hard that their strategy lost.
Yeah, totally.
And so it's very important that we connect all of our actions to a coherent strategy. That was one of the big criticisms of Obama.
Yeah.
Was like,
sorry to interrupt, but I was gonna raise the red flag again of, because we actually haven't talked about it, D-Ban stepped down from the National Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
I think since our last.
I think it was removed.
But he's used for that, is bogus.
Yeah, and it's not. It doesn't really mean that much because he's still a senior advisor. He still has security.
Yeah,
I think it is. Again, we're gonna do this for 4 years, but I think it is symbolically important.
I just think that like we have to look at like if there is a larger strategy, where is it coming from, and like. Instead of basically just like generals, who are in place just because of their rank and Trump kept on, the other person who has the most consistent strategy is Steve Bannon, and so
General Mattis maybe.
That's what I'm saying, General Mattis, but then like other like Security Council members, like they have an ongoing kind of strategy, right, an agenda, but Steve Bannon's the other one who has something consistent, so. That's just something to look at. Like, if there's a strategy, that's one thing we have to just like watch out for.
Right.
Is it his strategy taking form?
Yeah.
It's not clear. It's not clear.
No,
it's just
not
something
clear.
To.
I think he's losing ground. I mean, he's like warm tongue, right?
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
He's totally warm tongue.
Yeah.
Totally
warm tongue. he's obviously losing influence, which is important. Like, he's on the downhill, and I think what it sounds like is Trump is pissed about, because he was like the architect behind the travel ban and shit like that, which has gone bad. And if
that's
one thing, it's that Trump really likes to be liked, and he really likes to be seen as a winner.
Yeah.
And he's been getting beaten with a shovel.
But this was a good move for that, because
from
my understanding,
both sides,
it was pretty bipartisan.
Yeah. So. I mean, I guess we should be hopeful about that.
Right, that he's easily manipulated.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, I guess my fear is that if it's whoever has his ear that day, and there's no solid line of connection between long-term policy, when you have a guy like Rex Tillerson running your State Department, which is arguably the most important part of the entire government, and he has no clear connection to Trump most days, and doesn't talk to him about policy. You're like, that could be just a coin flip.
I was listening to a podcast, I think this morning, I forget what it was, forgive me. But they said that Trump advisors are now freaking out that they have no influence with him unless they're in the room, and so nobody will leave him. And so there's just like 15 people just like following him around. Like he did a New York Times interview and they had like 15 of his staffers in the room. Because nobody is leaving him alone. Because he's so untethered to any kind of like worldview that it's just whoever he talked to last.
Yeah.
That's why he was like, that Obama guy is pretty interesting when he met with him in the White House.
I wonder if he suffers from like short term memory loss or long term memory loss.
No, I think he suffers from narcissism.
And I think if we get to a meta level, like, this is, like, the imbibe that we were talking about before of just, like, going around, kind of just making decisions on the whim, which is like the chaos of our actual reality. It's almost like this is actually very, it's really messed up, but it's also accurate as to how the world operates.
That chaos strategy was really effective in the election.
Right, the campaign, it worked great.
It worked fantastic because everybody was off balance. And the only conversation was about Trump. Unfortunately, governing is different.
Well, here, I would also say that strategy may work in a nation as a form of nationalism. Yeah. But it does not work in the arena of globalism.
It doesn't
work.
Not.
And so that's the problem, I feel like, is you're seeing this try to translate the same strategy that may work within a country, because that's one thing, but relationships between nations is something totally different.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not working.
Is that because, we're going to get interesting. Is that because, so
I don't have time to get interesting.
Yeah. I posit that the international system is a state of anarchy. If each individual is a nation, or each nation is an individual, we live in a state of nature where
acting in its own self-interest.
Yeah. Yeah. And so is it that strategy is not effective globally because it's in a state of nature, where it is effective nationally because that person essentially has like a monopoly on the legitimate use of force? And so do you see what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And so like nations among each other operate with different rules and more anarchic rules than within a polity within a nation.
Right, because within a nation, we basically say to a relative degree that we agree on certain things, right? Mm-hmm. Then we're gonna play by certain rules. And we don't have to go into how fucked up many of those rules are, but the point is there's some sort of a system. But then another country has a totally different system, and like the UN, I guess, is like the thing that was attempting to like.
They're the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah, yeah, but it's like it's not effective. So you basically still just have other countries just like playing by different rules, and in that sense, it's like it's anarchical. There's not.
But I mean, even within the UN, there's a power structure, and certain countries have more power. The Security Council of the UN is the most powerful.
But there's not like a single leader there.
There's six countries.
Yeah.
Well, and also the UN, all of the UN, I mean, the most important things, the most meaningful powers in the UN are the power to block, not the power to do something.
Right.
And so UN, I do not think the UN acts as an effective enough governing body to like minimize the state of nature. Because if it did, then we would have 250,000 UN troops in Syria 3 or 4 years ago with a mandate, international mandate, to take away all weapons in the country and then fix the actual problem.
Right.
That's how like you give the UNT. I'm actually, heads up conspiracy theorists, I'm actually really in favor of the UN having a legitimate military force, because I think that's how you solve things like Syria. Now a bunch of people in Texas are going to think that UN tanks are going to roll into Texas. Heads up, everybody. The UN tanks are actually American tanks. So don't worry about it. But like, I do think that if we're actually going to go out and solve problems like that on a global stage, we cannot do it with a nation doing it. It has to be international. So we have to give the UN actual teeth to go out and compel nation states to do something.
Yeah.
But then we have a world government and like everybody melts down and conspiracies and all that.
Right, exactly.
But like that's how you solve global problems.
But in the eras of city states and nation states, it's impossible to ask a bunch of people to give up their sovereignty on the international level.
But like,
we're not prepared as a species to give up.
No, but there's precedent for it. Like, I think the march of human history has been towards world government, essentially. It
certainly looks that way right now with a globalized world where information...
If you know what I'm saying, if you zoom out from, like, 10,000 years ago, I'm saying a huge wide lens on the course of humanity, I think you see a clear, consistent pattern towards greater forms of organization. And you can see that... I'm ripping this off from Sapiens, but you can see that in there used to be world zones that were completely independent from each other.
Yeah.
So like there was an Aztec world zone that was essentially completely
like
separate.
A kingdom, right?
Yeah, and they had no interaction with other world zones. There are no more world zones. There is a single world zone.
Yeah.
And so in that, I think you see that the history of humanity is a story of greater organization. I believe that a world government is inevitable unless we blow ourselves up
first. Well, with technology too, it's inevitable.
It is inevitable. Yeah, yeah, and so for me, and this is like where I unify my nationalism and my globalism, I think, I believe in American values. And I think that they are less worse than most other governmental systems. And so I want to be able to lock in those values into a world system before it's too late. Because we're only 5% of the world's population. We're declining relative in power in all categories to other nations. And so we need to lock this in as soon as possible before the rules start getting made by the Chinese, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one thing, this is, if we go back to how do we get people, like nations, to connect with one another. So I believe that world government is basically, I don't know if it's inevitable, but it seems the direction in which we are going.
I think it already exists. I think it's just really inefficient. I think we're in the Articles of Confederation stage of world government.
Yeah. But do you think that's based more on political structures or an economic connectiveness?
All. Both. I think it is. Okay, so for instance, I am a huge fan of the American Navy because basically nobody gets on. We guarantee free trade. The American Navy does. And if we see in like the history of humanity, what comes first is trading, and then you get to know each other's culture through that, and then you get to understand that, like, oh my God, you're a human too, and like you just care about your family just like I do, and then you share culture, and then you end up not blowing each other up because you understand each other.
Yeah. And so that was going to be my point. Exactly that.
Is that like...
That's it, like you have to interact and see. It's like you're saying like basically countries are individuals. Those mm-hmm. individuals have to interact.
Yes.
And I think that what also happens is there's so... The other thing about it is though that it's not just an individual. Like it comes down to an individual. It's filled with thousands of millions of other individuals, right? So it's kind of like in order to have these mass interactions between cultures, like the psychological bit, that you're there's some form of getting to know each other, but I kind of wonder if we have to learn. We're not going to be able to just like all share the same culture. Like nationalism, we can share a certain structure, but I don't know if at the size, like the actual mass of people that we have globally, that kind of same ideology will work. And I think there has to be, we have to like ascend and sort of connect to each other as humans beyond something outside of a shared culture.
Sure.
Because the cultures will inevitably be different.
So we kind of have that issue in America already, right? Like right. We're such a mix of different cultures and religions, backgrounds,
yeah.
And histories.
That's why
America's like, one of the things that I really am stoked about right now that's happening in the country is, and I don't know if you guys have heard about this, some of us do it already, but like it's... There's been this movement to start your own, kind of your own traditions and your own, like playing board games on Thursday nights, you know, like having dinner on Sundays with music, you know, but like to create that need for like community and like a sense of belonging, totally. You know, like we... And the United States, I think, has a unique opportunity in this just because of how we've been created. But we already have started to do that, kind of, in like a local, like, you know, some of us do that. I don't know if you guys have heard of this, but I think if we can encourage that and educate people on how to, like, be a leader in that and come up with new ideas, just be, like, create your own culture, create your own, like, what do you like to do? Like, take this
like
from this
religion.
Sustaining
culture and arts.
Like,
that's
yeah.
why it's...
We're going to have to generate
so
that. I don't
yeah.
think we can latch on to anything that already exists. We can take bits and pieces of it. But I think naturally, as Americans, some people are already trying to do that and create their own traditions. And I think that's one way that we could solve that issue, you
right.
know, as we move into globalism.
Well, and also, I don't think that we have to necessarily have, like, the same culture to... We don't have to have a unified culture. We just have to have, like, understanding of each other.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I think we see that in... essentially English becoming a world language.
Right, a lot of people, yeah, there's like, yeah.
And so, and that's another sign of the unification of
yeah.
the world. I mean, how many languages were there in the year zero, and how many languages are there now?
Yeah.
Probably less,
yeah.
I would imagine,
I mean,
that are spoken.
It kind of sucks.
Yeah, there's
lots
of people that
yeah.
are love
yeah, but also,
that.
Okay, so like,
yeah.
let me defend that real quick. I think
no,
that...
No.
Like,
I'm not saying it's bad to have a shared language. I'm just saying that, it, like, the also a lot of the trend towards. So, like, I looked at Nepal because they have a shared language with Nepali. But then they have all of these other languages as well that are still the same. But, you know, a lot of people start to, not speaking their mother tongues anymore.
Dialects,
it starts to become,
right.
But they're from all different areas. They're not even derivative of Nepali, a lot of them. Yeah, they're totally different languages. Then they have this shared language. And a lot of people speak, like, 4 or 5 languages. But then this, now some of them are starting to get forgotten, especially with move away and, you know, places like, but, so I think that there's a loss in that, because when you speak different languages, like, languages are ways of viewing the world, it's like interpretations of being. And so when you lose that, I think that's something that's...
You lose some, like, psychological diversity.
But at the same time, being able to share a language is something that's really incredible and needs to be fostered. And it's unfortunate that English is that language, because it's kind of a second language, just putting that out there. But anyways.
But I think, John, you're getting a very good point about structuring some kind of global community. There's this idea that we're very tribal as human beings. There's always going to be an us versus them mentality, because it's easier for people to connect over cultural items that they agree on, you know, religion, food, language. And when you start talking about these international structures and international communities, there needs to be a strong common core that brings everybody together, that everybody can agree on. And I think American values are ones that are really supported by a lot of people around the world. The ideas of personal freedoms and personal rights, of individuality. And I think those are the type of things that can bring people together in that international community. It doesn't necessarily mean that you would be chopping parts of culture away from around the world, because you want to foster that and support that growth as well. But the base of it is that individuality and personal freedoms that the United States stands for.
And I think that the reason I'm into American values, why, like, I think that they're superior to other forms of organization that we have currently, are because they allow for diversity. They, like, I almost look at them as, like, meta values, where it's like, I'm into personal freedom for me and for everybody else. And
spoiler alert, the United States hasn't perfected that yet.
We're still working towards it. But it's your goal.
We're at least not being, like, Jehovah's Witness on a terrorist watch list like Russia is.
Right.
So I think that, like, we allow, American values allow the greatest amount of organization along with the greatest amount of diversity.
Right.
And so I think that, I mean, that's better than, like, fascism, right?
That's true.
I think it's better than fascism.
That's true.
I think I agree.
All right, it's my birthday. You guys ready? Okay, here we go. So I think that, like, that if you look at another course of human history.
Where are we about to go?
Which is, okay, we're deep in, we're getting towards the end. I just get to throw this out here because it's my birthday. All right, so if you look at the history of humanity, there was a time in which collectivism was the dominant psychological form over individualism. And we are now in another time for the last, like, 5,000 years or so, where individualism has, like, kind of come out as, like, the more dominant form in psychology, like, globally. There's still some cultures where it's more or less, but it's like this. And so I think that the move now is that those two things have to somehow come back together, and that that's going to require, like, a kind of a different understanding of what being a human even means. I think it's going to be a very
maybe
some sort of, like, evolution or transformation of, like, human consciousness, that we'll understand we are individuals, because we can't lose that piece, because it's, like,
but
so essential.
We're seeing that in a proto way.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's possible.
Like,
it's
social
totally
media
possible.
Does that.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
all having the same conversation.
Yeah.
And, like, we're all having a global conversation.
Yeah.
I could go to, I think, anywhere with an internet connection and have something to talk about with somebody. Like, at least we could be like, did you see the Olympics or something like that?
Or you can join a chat room
if you wanted to as well.
Well, yeah. But the point is, we could all have the same conversation.
Right.
That's why I'm trying to get better at football, because it isn't another international language. It's like, everybody plays soccer. Football is the proper term.
Okay. Really, we should call ours handball.
Oh,
yeah.
I absolutely.
And that's an interesting, like, that's like a joke that we have as, like, friends. If you all don't know, it's funny, and you're like, what are you talking about, football? But I mean, it's also an interesting thing, just like that's a form of globalism, adopting a term into a language from something else and, like, transforming a language. Just because, like, well, most of the people call it this, so maybe we should do that too. So maybe, like, we all are on the same page.
Yeah.
We should share that.
Metric system, anybody? fuck yeah, the metric system.
Man. Oh yeah, right, 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 yeah.
You know what's easier than dividing 5,280 by 12?
What?
Dividing 1,000 by 100.
Yeah, true. You know what else?
Math.
You know,
yeah. Zeros are easier.
You know what else? Out. The Pokemon game globally is in the metric system.
Is it?
So there's articles written about it.
Really?
It's teaching Americans the metric system.
I have Celsius on my phone because I'm trying to get used to it.
Right, right.
Yeah, it does make a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm. It makes a gajillion times more sense.
Yeah.
So, I guess, like,
perfect.
Is math the stopping point?
We end on math today.
We've got a couple more minutes.
I don't know. I'm feeling it, though. We're trying to hear
globalism versus nationalism.
Is there closing thoughts?
My closing thoughts is that we should adopt the metric system because it makes so much more sense.
Obviously.
And so that is my contribution to globalism, is that God damn it, America would be much better off if we adopted that.
Obviously, we're all going to agree on globalism right over nationalism, I think.
I am for globalism on American terms.
Which is a form of nationalism.
Yeah. It's a form of nationalism.
I mean, it's really a form of
nationalism. I think there's a combination of both.
It's definitely a combination of both.
I think
I am a nationalist.
Excellent. I mean, I think
this is
I love America too, but I also think that what's going to happen is when you actually have these relationships between governments, you find values that you share that actually elevate both of those things.
I agree.
You find the shared ground element, and so it's going to be partly from all us, but mm-hmm. also all other nations. It'll create something that's even better.
For example, I was super duper impressed with how the Japanese handled the tsunami and then the Fukushima, because they're more of a collectivist society, right? And so they didn't like lose their minds. I think if the United States had a similar instance, we would have seen a significant higher amount of chaos.
Hurricane Sandy, Three Mile Island, natural disaster.
Right,
there were different responses.
Yeah, and so I think that we could learn a whole lot from other cultures.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we have learned a lot from other cultures, right?
Yeah.
In
one of the other reasons why I feel comfortable saying that America should go out and try and promote values and should actually try and go out and represent the rest of the world, have a voice in it, is because we're the only country, or we're the country closest to representing all peoples in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have full representation, obviously, but we are far and away better than any other country in the world.
And we have to elevate the voices in our own country, right, that are not, that don't have that voice. And then at the same time, I think I lost my train of thought. Fuck.
Kelly, any last words?
No.
All right, so the question that I want to end on to ask you guys, and we'll end on this, and this is for you guys out there too, but let's say nationalism and globalism walk into a bar. All right?
Sounds like a great joke set.
Yeah.
Nationalism, globalism, and Steve Bannon walking
to a bar. Steve Bannon watches from afar and keeps to himself because he's like that weird guy that nobody talks to.
Screwed.
But it turns out globalism and nationalism end up having a beer, and then beer and shot, and you know, they get along. Before you know it, they're going back, they hook up. 9 months later, out pops a baby. What would we name that baby?
Wow. America.
No.
We don't have to answer
it. Valtrax X, security anthem.
I don't know what that is.
It's nationalism, globalism, and baby. What would its name be?
He wants a name. He wants to be what is globalism and nationalism if they were to...
It's the next evolution, right?
Yeah, if they were to come together and there's something to be shared.
Abraham Churchill.
Or you're assuming it's a boy.
Abraham Churchill.
Hey,
Lauren, we got a question for you.
Yeah.
Mal Lincoln.
If globalism and nationalism got together, and long story short, they end up having a baby together,
uh-huh.
What would they name their baby?
Globalism and nationalism got together. What would they name their baby?
I said America.
Don't, we're not giving them no.
The first thing that popped in my head was democracy. But right? Because it's the sort of merging of centralized and then decentralized mindsets and powers.
Yeah,
I like that.
Anyway, that's all I got for you.
All right, we'll end right there.
Until next time.
Thanks, Lauren.
Bye, world.
Peace.
Cheers.
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 Goodbye, boys.
Yeah, nice.
Thank you.